If you'll turn to Exodus chapter 21, so we are reading through the Bible chapter by chapter, and we are in it now. We are really in it. We're starting to look at the law that God gave Israel, and we tried to do a lot of prep for this to get ready, because this is definitely a more difficult section of the scripture to understand and to appreciate, and even sometimes to know how to apply. It can seem boring to us if we're reading through the Bible in a year or something and we come to a section like this. It definitely is one of those sections that we are tempted to skip ahead to Joshua maybe, or Judges. Someone was telling me they were reading Exodus while I was preaching last week, and they got to chapter 20 and they stopped because they thought this is the boring part, 20 and 21. It was a younger person, but that's not necessarily how the Bible thinks of it, actually. I was going to have us actually start by reading Psalm chapter 1, but I can just read verses 1 and 2. It says, "Blessed is the man who walks not in the counsel of the wicked, nor stands in the way of sinners, nor sits in the seat of scoffers, but his delight is in the law of the Lord, and on his law he meditates day and night." And then Psalm 119, the longest chapter in the Bible, you know it, but how many verses in there are like, "Oh, how I have loved thy law, and I've rejoiced in your law more than riches." And that's not just these laws we're about to read, but it is these laws. And so the Bible's attitude, the point is, the Bible's attitude towards this is a little different than ours. And whenever the Bible has a different attitude than me, who's right? It's really not complicated, like the Bible's right. So I like to try to pay a special attention to the parts of the Bible that seem boring to me, because those are times where I know something's not clicking. And it might not be that it's going to be quite as exciting at first as I might wish, but life's not all about things being exciting either. But we know it's valuable. That's the point. And so we want to approach this section well. We know we've got some challenges because it's not the kind of thing we would normally read, and because our own hearts might be a little bored by it. And so sometimes we have to, "Happy birthday to you, happy birthday to you, happy birthday to you, John, happy birthday to you." It's John's birthday. He just entered, yeah. Yeah. So, so we know that reading these laws, we have to prepare for. And one way to prepare for it is just to remind yourself that it's part of a story, and it's an exciting story about how God is fixing all the problems of the world. And we definitely need the problems in this world to be fixed. And only God can fix it. That's pretty clear. And you remember how he's doing that. He's choosing this nation, Israel. He's rescuing Israel. He's going to put them in the promised land, and they're going to be like a showcase to the world. They're supposed to be a showcase to the world of what it looks like to live with God as king, to draw the world to God. And before he takes them there, he has to prepare them. They've been living in Egypt for a long time, and he wants to prepare them to be able to really succeed, thrive in the promised land, and do what he's called them to do. And one of the things that he's done to prepare them is he's taken them into the wilderness, and he's taught them about the importance of faith, trusting him, and about his authority. And now in chapter 19, he comes to them and explains their purpose, and really the purpose of the laws that he's about to give them. And he says, if you obey my laws — this is one of the biggest passages there in the Old Testament for understanding Israel, Exodus 19, 4-6. He's like, if you obey my laws, you're going to be a kingdom of priests. And priests were someone who represented the people to God and God to the people. And so this whole nation was supposed to be like priests to who? To the world. They were supposed to represent God to the world. And Israel's like, yay, we're in. They accept it. So God, it's almost, this is very different than how it would normally work with a king and a superior, inferior. They don't, when they make a contract, the superior doesn't like offer the contract to people in the ancient world. You know, Pharaoh didn't like, "Hey, would you guys like to be my slaves? So this is what you'll get." This is radically different. God comes with an offer. He rescues them. He shows them grace. And then basically comes with an offer to Israel that if you'll obey, this is what will happen and this is what I'll do. And they say that's what they want to do. They're all in. They want to obey. And so God comes after showing them that grace and after explaining their purpose, he gives them his law, these rules. And these rules that we're about to read are intended to be a blessing for them. And if they kept them, Israel would be a blessing for the world. So God wasn't just giving his people a job and then leaving them to figure it out on their own. He was like stooping down to help them by giving them specific instructions about how they could live in a way that would glorify him. In Exodus 20, we looked at that last time, and that's almost like the basic overarching principles. So that's like the notes on a 3x5 card in a sense. Like this is kind of the basics. And then in chapters 21 to 23, God gives them some more specific examples of what it would look like to live out the Ten Commandments in the nitty-gritty realities of life in this sinful, broken world. And some of the laws that we're going to read are going to be hard for us to understand, so get ready for it. And part of the reason for that is because we're living in a broken world. Part of that's because we're living so many years later. So, like, the context is so different. Most of us don't live on farms, and most of us, we have a whole different kind of economy even now. So this is where it becomes challenging reading the law. You, like, have to really use your imagination to put yourself back in the situation so we can understand the world the way they did and understand what God's actually saying. Like, one of the dangers always with we talked about cross-cultural communication on Sunday, but one of the dangers always with cross-cultural communication is somebody says a word and you think you know what they mean by that word because you use that word, but they are coming from a whole different place, and so they take that word, they say that word, a whole different image comes to their mind when they say that word. So you're talking about one thing, they're talking about one thing, you're using the same word. And so you think you're really having a good conversation, but you're completely missing each other. And that's a challenge when you read the Bible, because most of us don't read like documents written thousands of years ago hopefully we do read one every day, but we don't read many others. We don't read Hammurabi's laws every day or something like that. So it takes a little bit of work. And then it also may be hard for us because we understand the law a little differently than they did. And this is a little new for me, so I think through it. I can send you a couple links on this that I've found really helpful. But when we think about law in our day, like if I was going to say, give me an example of a law, you would probably say, you'd probably say like the speed limit. So that's normally how we think of a law. There's a law, it's very specific. If you break it, you get a fine. If you don't pay the fine, you go to jail. So we think of laws basically in terms of breaking them or keeping them, doing, not doing. But biblically, it's a little bit different. Obviously, you could break the law, but it's a little bit different. And it's different for a couple reasons, but this is how somebody puts it. In the world of biblical law, legal code, what we're reading, is a form of reasoning with Israel to shape her wisdom. So this is how Deuteronomy 4:6 says it. Oh, actually, you can just look there, Deuteronomy 4:6. He's explaining the purpose of the law in Deuteronomy 4:6. He says, keep the statutes, or keep them, and do them, for that will be your wisdom and your understanding in the sight of the peoples, who when they hear all these statutes will say, surely this is a great nation. This great nation is a wise and understanding people. And so, other ancient nations didn't all have the law code. So most people didn't know the law. So this is just different than God would tell the average ordinary person the law. But second of all, it wasn't so much the breaking the law, but it was keeping the law, and that was a term they used for shepherding or guarding. So the metaphor, this is a quote here, but the metaphor for disobedience is not listening or rejecting or crossing against. So the biblical authors portrayed lawfulness neither as rule-following nor as law-breaking, but rather as formative. Ultimately, Israel must become the kind of people who exhibited principled justice as concrete examples of living together under God's kingship. So let me keep going here. But one scholar puts it, the English word law is too narrow and too misleading to accurately translate the Hebrew word Torah. It's better translated as instruction. Torah encompasses a wider scope of material than just laws, and law is not the best word to describe what the Torah contains. Here's why. In modern Western society, law refers to a statute codified by the legislature that indicates either required or prohibited behavior, containing specific penalties that are enforceable by the executive branch of the government. Often their precise details are specified at length. Buckle up, it's the law. Means that not only is it a good idea to wear a seatbelt in a moving vehicle, it's also unlawful not to do so, leading to a prescribed fine. Ancient law didn't function in exactly the same way. Laws were for legislation, but they were for more than that. They were for teaching the people how to think, how to be wise. And they had to be, because they didn't have police. They didn't have jails. So this was all stuff that happened within the context of a local community. And maybe just to keep going here, biblical law is intended to make you think hard. That's why I think the psalmist is like, blessed is the man who meditates on it day and night. We wouldn't meditate on breaking the speed limit, usually. We're like, well, what is there to think about? But biblical law is different. You would think about it. It would be something it's like teaching you how to live in this world. So they had been saved by God. God gave them this mission, and these laws were given them to study and think through how they could fulfill that mission as God's people, and what that would look like. And so, again, it's different. Nowadays, we might have a law, and we might say, look up that law in the, like, California law book or whatever they have, and they're like, here's every single way you can violate the law. And that's, like, it. You know, that's all the ways you can violate the law. And here's what will happen if you do violate that law. But that's not exactly how it would work with biblical law. Instead, what they're kind of giving you is a example, a very specific example that's based on a principle. And then you have to reason and think about how that principle might look in the particular situations and what are the ramifications for that principle in life today. So, I mean, yeah, the weird example would be, it gives laws about relationships, the kind of relationships you're supposed to have, like husband, wife, and within a family, if you know what I'm talking about. And it doesn't say, you know, grandma. You're not allowed to have the husband-wife relationship with grandma. But it does bring up a lot of other examples. And it assumes that you're going to be able to reason and understand, no, based on this law and these principles, this is not acceptable. This doesn't work. You wouldn't go to the biblical law and say, oh, this specific example is not there, so I can do it. No, you'd go to the biblical law and say, this is a principle here, and this is then how this principle should apply in my specific situation. And or it's like an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. So if you have a one-eyed man, he's got one eye, and he pokes out the eye of somebody with two eyes. You don't say, well, an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth. The one-eyed man, now he has no eyes. I'm going to poke that out. You would go to it and say, no, what's the principle? The principle is that what you do to someone else, the consequences are going to be equal to you. So if you poke out both eyes, that's not an equal consequence because the other guy, you know, he still has one eye. So now you have to think through, how do I apply this principle in this particular situation? It's giving me a specific example, but I'm going to have to reason and think about how to apply that law. And in Moses' day, a lot of times it would be the elders and judges, if it got to that point, who would have to take the law and then think through how it applies. And we don't have every single one here, but we have many of the laws that are given to us to think through. And that's actually what some people are thinking is going on here in Exodus chapter 21, even more specifically, that these are laws that judges would use, but our elders would use, but at the same time, they're laws for us all to think about and then ask how to apply. Another example would be, like, even maybe more today would be easy to think about. Like, in the ancient world, they would say you're not supposed to glean to the edge of your field. And the reason that you're not supposed to glean to the edge of your field is so that poor people could come and they would be able to glean and be able to provide for themselves. But you couldn't say, like, nowadays, say you wanted to apply that law nowadays. It wouldn't make sense if you were a farmer not to glean to the edge of your field, because poor people don't know how to glean. Like, nobody's going to come in America to the edge of your field and glean there, because I wouldn't know what to do, you know, at the edge of a field if they left that. So nowadays, what you would do to apply that law is you would say, okay, what's the principle behind that law? This is a whole different context. What's the principle behind that law is that, one, those who have more are supposed to think about those who have less, and make sacrifices, not just be all about me and my family, but make sacrifices to make it possible for others to survive. And then you might even take it a step further. They didn't just give. They actually provided a kind of work, a way for those people to be able to provide for themselves. And then you could think about, okay, what would it look like to obey that law in this context? And that's kind of how the law was supposed to work. It's intended to make you think and form you into a person who knows how to love God and love your neighbor well in this world. And the laws that we're going to look at now are going to make us think, for sure. And one reason they're going to make us think is because God does not, he absolutely does not begin where we would. And we can see that right away if you look at the kind of the bold print above Exodus 21. I mean, laws about slaves. So that is surprising in and of itself. You know, that's enough to make an atheist happy. And actually, they'll often bring that up. You know, oh, look at the Bible. The Bible's so great. It has laws about slavery there. Why don't you have in the Ten Commandments, thou shalt not have no slaves, or something like that? And so lots of people have problems with that. And you can understand, living all these years later. What are some reasons people have problems with that without even reading it? One is because we are in a history like slavery means something to us. And so it's a word that you can't even say without a whole history. And so we just have to ask, first of all, is that what it meant to them? Are we talking about even the same thing? Would be a good first question. And yeah, second of all, because sometimes we're a little naive about the reality for poor people, even in our own world today, that we might call things by different names that are actually more similar to what is happening here. So when we lived in Africa, there were many refugees who would come down to where we lived. And when I looked at their life, what was going on in their life, it was worse than what a lot of slavery was. You didn't call it slavery, but because of the economic system and the way it worked there, it was basically slavery, but without any regulations. You know, that their bosses owned them. And so I think that's one reason we sometimes struggle, is we've got the history, and because we are a little naive about what is actually happening nowadays. And because there's some things we're missing. This is what it's talking about here when it talks about slavery, is what you would call debt slavery. And so this is when somebody gets in trouble financially, and they need help, and they take on debt from other people, and they get to the point where they're not able to pay back their debt, and so they're going to lose their land and all of that kind of stuff. And so there's another family or another farm in the community in which they live, and they go to that other farm because they're going to die. They're at the point where they're not able to survive. They go to that other person, and they make an agreement to work for that farm to pay off the debt. Here's how a person explains it. Say you went bankrupt and you'd already sold the farm. Your options at this point were simple. You and your children could starve to death, or you could use the only thing you had left, your labor, to pay off your debt and to try to get back on your feet. Under this kind of arrangement, you would voluntarily and temporarily become part of someone else's family business, working alongside of them and their children for a limited period of time to pay off your debt. That's hard for us to imagine, but if you have a mortgage or an employment contract longer than a day, then in the ancient world, you would be called a slave. LinkedIn hadn't been invented yet, nor had companies or Social Security. Remember, these were brutal times and options were limited. Starve to death in the desert or work in someone else's household as a slave. Slavery was everywhere in the ancient worlds, but God here, he's putting measures in place, basically, to help make sure the rich don't take advantage, like they always do, of those who are in desperate conditions. And then another difference, and this is a quote as well, as a Hebrew bankruptcy slave, you kept your rights and dignity even while you worked for someone else, so you could bring lawsuits against your master. That's one thing that's said here. Your master owned your time and not your body. He had to give you the Sabbath. You were like part of his family, really. And here's really the kicker. They're going to give a command to towns in the community, you know, towns surrounding towns, that they had to give refuge to a runaway slave. So in Israel, if you didn't like the way you were being treated, you could walk to the next town, and then they were obliged to protect you. So, obviously, that would be a different kind of slavery. It's a different, whole different kind of thing that we're talking about here. And that means when we read the Bible and these laws, we have to be patient and humble and ask questions, rather than just get upset and throw the Bible across the room and say, this is dumb, I can't believe God is so backward like this. Like, no, slow down and make sure you know what you're talking about before you get too upset. And sometimes it's hard because it's so different. But one of the questions you might ask is, why does this come first? Like, if you're going to write a set of laws, you're going to make a covenant with a group of people, like, laws about slaves really as your first grouping of laws? That's like, that, first of all, that's, you know, you look, there were other ancient Near Eastern law codes, and this is very different. That would not be something that comes first in other ancient Near Eastern law codes at all. So that's different. Now, it doesn't obviously come first. Actually, what comes first is the Ten Commandments. And look back at Exodus 20, verse 2. How do the Ten Commandments begin? And this might be a hint as to why laws about slaves begins the more specific set of laws. It begins, I am the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery. So God rescued Israel from slavery. And I think as you look at these laws, they're not actually so much about slavery as they are about how to prevent people from taking advantage of others when they're in crisis situations. And I think maybe what is happening here is, you know what happens when someone's rescued from a bad position and they're brought to a better position. Unfortunately, just in real life, they don't usually become more merciful. You would think that's how it would work. You're rescued from a bad position. You remember where you came from, and you treat with mercy people who were in the situation like yours. But I'm telling you, in this world, that's not often how it works. Like, read the story of every dictator in Africa. Most of those guys, they started out in terrible positions. Somehow they rise to the top and they don't become more merciful. Even the story of South Africa, it's so complex, of course, but like apartheid, a group of people really mistreated. Then things switch. Some of them rise to positions of power. And you know what? For most of South Africa, it's not that much different than the days of apartheid still in terms of financially and economically. And there's still a lot of corruption. And even if South Africans are doing well, many of those who come from other countries are not doing well. A real practical example of that, my friends who are refugees in the inner city, you know, the way they're treated by police is we had a guy who was an intern with us, an American, who went down to sell his scooter in the inner city to some guy from another country. And he was in the car selling the scooter, and the police came by, and they get them all out of the car, put them on the ground, you know, and they just start beating them and calling him Mzungu, you know, you Mzungu, which a white person, and just beating him. And then they go on to the next group, you know, without any explanation. And my friend was obviously, that was really traumatic. And so we started talking about that to different people from because our church was pretty mixed. And so some people be like, no, that can't happen. That never happens in South Africa, you know, like shocked. And then all the refugees are like, what are you talking about? That happens all the time. Like, I just saw that yesterday looking out my window. And so, but it wasn't the old era policemen who were doing that, like the apartheid era policemen who were doing that. It was actually South African policemen who were doing that to people from Africa, but different parts of Africa. And so that's often, unfortunately, what happens in the world when someone rises to a position of power. It's not like that's unusual there, and it wasn't unusual back then. And so here what's going on is God doesn't want his people to be like that. Like, he's rescued them from slavery, from bondage. And so what he wants to say at the beginning is, that should impact the way they relate to others who find themselves in trouble. And we can look at some of the specifics here about how that should impact. And I'm telling you, it's going to take some thinking. So we'll just do our best. It's hard for me too, for sure. But we'll start off with verses 1 to 6. And Donna, you can begin.
Exodus 21. Yep. Now these are the rules that you shall set before them. When you buy a Hebrew slave, he shall serve 6 years, and in the seventh he shall go out free for nothing. If he comes in single, he shall go out single. If he comes in married, then his wife shall go out with him. If his master gives him a wife, and she bears him sons or daughters, the wife and her children shall be her master's, and he shall go out alone. But if the slave plainly says, I love my master, my wife, and my children, I will not go out free, then his master shall bring him to God, and he shall bring him to the door or the doorpost, and the master shall bore his ear through with an awl, and he shall be his slave forever.
Okay, so there's already some things. Usually our minds go straight to the parts that we think are weird, but we'll approach that slowly. So what does verse 2 do just on the offset, like at the beginning? What is going on in verse 2 that's, you might say, positive about dealing with someone who's poor?
You're not a slave for life.
Right.
6 years and then 7 through 8.
Yes, which is, so if you think about even today, like people who are in debt will go sometimes, they can't find a loan, and they'll go to somebody who will give them a loan. And what the person who gives the very poor person a loan does often is take advantage of their desperate situation, right? And they'll put such interest on that loan, like a person who's financially stable would never take that loan. But someone who's in a crisis situation, he has to take that loan. And the interest is so high that basically he becomes like a slave to that debt forever. He can't ever, you know, this is part of the problem with poverty. It's like you can't ever get out of it, because it's just everywhere you turn for help, it's actually they're putting you in another form of slavery. And so God's saying, no, that's not the way it's going to work. You get yourself in a bad debt. You work to get it off. But he can't keep adding to that debt. And you can imagine the person doing something like that. Like, okay, you lived in my house. Well, Laban did it to Jacob, really.
Well, in today's society, it's like the payday.
Right.
Cash apps.
Yep. Yes.
So it's like a never-ending cycle that they can't get out of.
That's right. And God's saying no. I understand that he might have to work to pay off his debt for a period of time. But no, it can't continue forever.
Yeah.
And so he puts a limit. It's a 6-year. So already it's different than the way we think about slavery. This is like working to pay off a debt for 6 years, basically. And then he goes free. So there's limits. And actually, later, Deuteronomy, if you go to Deuteronomy 15, this is kind of... shows you also how the law works. There might be a law here, and then later on in the law, they'll come back to that and expand and illustrate it more. But Deuteronomy chapter 15 says this, verse 12, if your brother, a Hebrew man or a Hebrew woman, is sold to you, he shall serve you 6 years, and in the seventh year you shall let him go free from you. And when you let him go free from you, you shall not let him go empty-handed. You shall furnish him liberally out of your flock, out of your threshing floor, and out of your winepress. As the Lord your God has blessed you, you shall give to him. You shall remember that you were a slave in the land of Egypt, and the Lord your God redeemed you. Therefore, I command you this today. So it's actually like you threw a big party for this guy when he left you. And you were trying to make sure that, okay, now he's obviously leaving. He paid off his debt, but he's still poor. So I want to send him away with some sort of resources so that he can survive. Imagine if payday apps did that. You know, you pay off your debt, and then they show up at your door and like, okay, here's an extra $5,000 just so that you don't have to get in debt again very quickly. Verse 3, clearly... You, first of all, it sets limits. Second of all, you can't take advantage of him. If he comes in single, goes out single, comes in married, then his wife shall go out with him. And that's kind of the overarching idea that we have to see as we look at this. And no one thought about the rights of the poor in these days. So this already is shocking. No one thought about the rights of the poor. And that helps as we come to verse... this is what's sometimes funny, even nowadays, like people get upset at the Bible, but you're like, do you know why you get upset at the Bible? It's because of the Bible. You know, like you have a concern for the poor. You know where you got that from? You didn't get that from just the air out there. That comes from Judeo-Christian values. That comes from like the way the Bible taught you to think. It taught you to be concerned about the poor, because nobody was concerned about the poor in the ancient world. The Bible shaped the way we think to the point where we don't even realize that it shaped us. But once we get untethered from the Bible, then we get all weird. We don't know. But the point is, they want us to be concerned about the rights of the poor. But then verse 4, and this is a little more difficult. Because here we got a master give a wife to the, and he has a couple kids. And then he's like, okay, you can leave, but the wife stays with me. And so we're like, what is going on? And one thing to remember, in these laws, we're dealing with hypothetical situations. So again, you have to think. And what's going on is, if you're a farmer, you do terribly, you get in trouble, you go to another farmer, you're working for him until you can pay off the debt. If you came in single, you go out single. You came in married, you go out married. In other words, the rich person couldn't have you work 7 years for your debt and then say, okay, now your wife needs to work 7 years more years for your for the debt. No, no. It was your debt. It was only one person. But then what happened if you got married to one of your master's servants while you were there? While you were working off your debt. And so this is a situation you have to think about, because your master is actually being generous because he's looking out for you, and he has to pay money in order for you to be able to get married to this servant, because that's how it worked in the day. And the lady has a debt as well, which she owes to the master. So one author says this is where verse 4 kicks in. So the woman is working off a different debt than the man is. And where are the children positioned in all this? If the master's feeding them, whose debt are they working off, or none at all? Are they just working for food? So the wife, he's saying, is considered to have a different debt in this situation than the husband. And so his freedom has nothing to do with hers. And at this point, what could the man do? He could wait for the wife to finish working off her debt. Then she and the children would be free to go join the husband, because, you know, 6 years, you could only work 6 years, and then the seventh year you would go free. The husband could use some of the money he has to pay off her debt so she can join him sooner rather than later. And if it's a good place to work, he can commit himself to a more permanent status of employment there. And they had a way of doing that, verses 5 and 6, which of course seems strange to us. But living in ancient Israel was like being part of someone else's household. And so, say you had worked in this person's house for 6 years, your wife worked there as well. It's a family. It's like you're living in a family situation. Even the Sabbath, you know, you all have to take off the Sabbath together. And you're like, I like being part of this family. And I'm not a very good farmer on my own. So I'm better at work. I'm one of those guys who's better at working for someone else than being my own entrepreneur. So I can make a deal where I commit myself to them for a lifetime. And I do it in a way that makes clear to everybody else that I chose this, and that this a man isn't taking advantage of me. This is a love relationship. So that's the first situation. Now the second situation, verses 7 through 11, and this is also going to seem a little weird, but give it a moment. David. Conjugal rights, yeah. Marital rights, yeah.
If he will not do these three things for her, then she shall go out for nothing without payment of money.
Okay. So again, a couple things going on here. First of all, just to recognize, like, if I put you on a plane today and took you to the middle of, I don't know, we'll just say Africa because I'm from Africa. If you take you to the middle of Africa and put you down in a village and say, I want you to make this village live according to the Western lifestyle, to American rules, that would not work. You know, it's not just that you could set up a bunch of rules on the post and like, okay, this is how you're all going to live today. They got a whole way of thinking that it's going to take a long time. Not that Western is better. I'm just saying as an illustration. That it would take a long time for you to be able to get them to think a little, to to understand even what you're saying on those rules. You would have to take so much time. So what you would have to do, most likely, is you would have to think, okay, here's the situation I'm living with, and I need to think through, how do I move? How do we exist in this situation and move towards a more, set them on a trajectory towards a different kind of lifestyle? That's probably a terrible illustration because I just made it, but it's also like an example of what God's having to deal with Israel. Like, he's having to reshape people who have come out of Egypt for the last 400 years and to a people that will put his glory on display. And so it's not quite so simple as like, do this, do that, do this, do that. He's having to deal with people who have a whole way of thinking about the world and having to put rules in place that one, or principles in place that one, deal with the way they actually are, and that also set them on a path towards being something different. And so even some of these laws about slavery, and they're doing that. They're dealing with people as they actually are, but if you actually start thinking through these principles and applying them, what's going to end up happening is you don't have that kind of a situation any longer. But here in this setting, it's really weird for us because it feels like, you know, we're dealing with ladies different than we are dealing with men. And in a sense we are, but also the reality is this is a different kind of slavery that's going on. So this is different. When he uses the word slave here, it's different. Here's another quote from a scholar, but the Hebrew term for slave here does not mean a slave girl in the usual sense, since her status is different from the male slave. The following laws safeguard her rights and protect her from exploitation, a specific kind of exploitation. In the ancient world, a father driven to poverty might sell his daughter into a well-to-do family in order to secure her future security. The sale presupposes marriage to the master or to the son. So you can imagine the situation. This man helps the woman, agrees to marry her, and the law is like, you can't just take advantage of her. You need to let her be redeemed. And if you're not willing to provide for her and treat her like a wife, then she's free. So in South Africa, they had something. You don't just get married to somebody. You have a whole, there's a whole tradition around how you get married. And part of the tradition is actually involves money and like goats and, you know, cows or whatever. But like all the uncles and aunts will come and say, the man has to pay this much to the wife's family. And a lot of people don't get married because they don't have the money to pay for this labola. And so in the ancient world here, the man, it was a little different, but there was still that financial aspect. And what's happening here is the man is required. The man is taking that on himself. The wife's family would give the money to the man's family or the things to the man's family. And the man is taking that on himself and saying, no, you can give your daughter to me. We'll get married. There's no financial burden on you. And that helps the poor family whose daughter couldn't get married because they wouldn't be able to normally pay the labola or whatever they called it back then. They wouldn't be able to pay the price. And yet now she's in that situation and the husband, it's like in a sense he's bought her, you know, he's paid the price that she was supposed to pay or her family was supposed to pay. And so God knows what would a man would be tempted to do in that situation if he didn't like her, was just treat her like a piece of property. And so here he's giving rules or laws to say, no, you can't take advantage of her that way. And if you're not willing to treat her the way you would treat a wife, then she's free to go. She's not really your wife. You're breaking the covenant with her. So of course, you know, some of the specifics of this we need to do more work to understand and put ourselves back in the situation. But that's kind of the basic idea of what's going on here. And if we just look at these laws by themselves, what are some of the things that already we're learning about God and living in this world today?
God cares about women.
Yeah.
Way more than the world tells us.
Yes. I mean, and in this day, this is like, eyes, no, I can't even believe it. So back then, this is really shocking. And even today, we're reminded God does, he is looking out for women and also just for the vulnerable, for the vulnerable. Usually, it's the rich who have all the laws working in their favor. And the poor can't get a voice to get, everything seems stacked against them. And God, from the beginning, is putting things in place for the vulnerable. And another thing this shows is like God wants the way we're saved to impact the way we live. And so he showed them such grace in rescuing them from slavery. And so he's like, think about it, guys. Think about it. You should be gracious people. And I think for us, even today, is we need to be careful not to take advantage of others just because they're in vulnerable situations. And probably we could do some more thinking about that, because the reality is, like, we're trained by our culture in a certain lifestyle, and part of the way our culture trains us is not to notice. Not to notice. And it's hard. It's sometimes really complicated. So we were over here yesterday. There was a somebody sleeping there, and they've got all their stuff like piled up. And then there's some guys that are sleeping on the porch there. And we got a picture from somebody that's living over here about this person here. I guess asking us to do something about it. And so that is a good example of like how today you have to think, what does it look like to love my neighbor? Because I got two neighbors there in very different situations. So my first instinct is to love this neighbor, the one who's sleeping there, and to think, okay, you know, there still should be a place in the world where you can sleep on their property and they're not thinking this makes it look bad. And the church should be like a place like that, you know, like if it's not. But then I had to think, okay, there's ladies, there's apartment buildings there, there's ladies that walk by there late at night. We're dealing with situations with a different kind of homelessness even than sometimes I was used to in Africa, where there's more maybe mental illness or drugs that are involved. And so I also have to think, what does it look like for us to love our neighbor who's walking by late at night, scared to go to their apartment? And so then Isaiah and I walk out there, and you know, the person sleeping at 11 at night, in the morning, with their head on the ground and on their knees, and their their bum in the air, and thinking, this is a human being, you know, like, who's sleeping like this on the side of the church building at 11 in the morning. This is something significantly. We can't just be like, it doesn't look good. And at the same time, we have to think, there are others that I have to be concerned about as well. And so the point is, life is complicated, and yet we need to slow down. And work hard. It's not always going to be so easy as like, do this, don't do that. But it needs to be like, how do I live as a loving, wise individual in this world? And in this case, we waited, and Isaiah was able to talk to the person and look for a place for them to go besides that spot. And then we've decided with the guys on the front to, because it's so much light, there's the train that's there, and to not say anything about them sleeping there right now, because they're not really creating any danger for anyone, and it might just mean that we need to clean up a little bit on Sundays. But it just feels like you should be able to sleep on the porch of a church if you're looking for a place to sleep. But anyway, not everyone's going to agree with all the specifics of that, but the point is that God wants us not just to go with the flow, but to push back against the flow, and it's not always going to be easy to know the exact right thing to do in every situation. I found this so hard in Africa because, you know, every single light was someone asking for something. And some of the guys, as I got to know them, that were asking for something, it was actually a lifestyle, like almost like gambling. Instead of going and dealing with the situation, what can I get? You know, like I might get something tomorrow by standing at the light. What can I get? So it wasn't always merciful to give, because it, you know, part of the consequence, God sometimes uses painful experiences to change us. And if they're not painful, then we don't change. We're not forced to change. And yet at the same time, just driving by them all the time tended to create, you know, you stopped looking. And there was also difficult because once you looked, you were in a relationship. You know, like, so if you didn't look, they just walked by you. But once you looked, even if you didn't have anything, you were like there for a long conversation, you know, like somebody just standing at your window forever. And so it was very tempting to just almost develop the habit of not looking. And then the fear is having a heart that is so calloused towards the needs of others that you never see. So anyway, point is, complicated living in the world. And that's part of how the law is supposed to help us. It's supposed to force us, we're supposed to meditate on these things and try to think about what are the principles so many years ago, but what are the principles that we can draw from these laws that might help us even live in a way that is wise today. And he goes on here, I can't believe that I didn't finish this chapter of all the chapters, but I just didn't. We only have 4 minutes, and there's really a lot more here. So I'm sorry, but later on here in this chapter, what you'll see is there's actually one of the first explanations of ransom and redemption, and how that works. And it's really a very specific situation. At first, you're going to be tempted to read over it and like, doesn't apply to me. But that concept that's presented there becomes very important later for understanding even redemption in the Bible and what Jesus did for us. It has to do with an ox and so and all that. But the concept of how something is redeemed becomes really important later on in the Bible. But thanks, guys. Any thoughts or questions?